Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we can see? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Yes, indeed. We're going to have a Solartopia all over God's green world. That's Pete Seeger, the much-missed, fantastic, legendary Pete Seeger, singing with Doug Williams and David Burns, the Rivertown Kids on the Tomorrow's Children album, the Grammy-winning Tomorrow's Children album. Honored to be on that, and much honored, as always, to have Pete Seeger bring us into another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We've got a great guest today, Peter Scheer, calling us from sunny Southern California. Peter, are you with us?
I am. Hi, Harvey. How are you?
I'm great, Peter. How are you? Peter is a radio host himself. Where is your radio show, Peter? It's on KPFK, is that correct?
It is on KPFK in Los Angeles. It's Truth Dig Radio, and our address is truthdig.com/radio.
And you are the editor in chief, or is that your dad, of the truthdig.com website?
That's my dad. I'm humbly the managing editor.
All right. Well, we know how that goes. I'm looking at the site right now. I'm anxiously awaiting at some point, sometime today. I think you're going to post my next piece. If we get it up during the hour, we can talk about it. But Peter, you how long have you edited this website?
I've been with it for about 7 years. I'm not sure, not from the beginning, a couple of years into it. And I started sending out Bob's books and then moved to posting The Daily Show and The Colbert Report late at night and became a night editor and eventually wound up as managing editor.
Well, you want, so, like Robert F. Kennedy Sr., you worked hard and hard and year after year and then became a general. But it's a great, it's a beautiful site. I'm honored to be published there when you see fit to put my stuff up. And we'll talk about it in a bit. I want to talk about a few things before we get to the specific of your site. Specifically, and most importantly, your Truth is a very, very political site. Of course, it has a very wide following. How many, how do we gauge the following of a website? Do we gauge it by the number of hits, the length of people that people stay? How do you figure out how big you are?
Well, that's a really good question, because actually, you know, it varies wildly depending on when things go viral or you're able to reach a wider audience than usual, and that's what most media outlets aspire to. What we're really proud of is that we have a very loyal following that's stuck with us through thick and thin. And when we have these surges of traffic, we like to retain some number of people. But we're also really proud to win both, you know, new media and old media awards for our coverage. It's important that our peers recognize us. So we've won a number of LA Press Club awards, for instance, Maggie Magazine Publishing Awards. We've won also the Webbies a few times for best political blogs. So it's a big mix, and we're very proud of it.
Good. Okay. Well, let's talk first and foremost about the most important piece of news to come down the pike for a while, which is this latest, shall we say, nauseating, sickening, insane, and profoundly anti-democratic Supreme Court decision on money and politics, the McCutcheon decision. What is your take on it, and how will it affect what you do at Truth Dig?
Well, I think what's interesting about the McCutcheon decision is it shows that there was this moment when John Roberts sort of was the swing vote on gay marriage that we thought maybe he was a little bit more politically savvy. Certainly he showed that in through the nominating process. I mean, this was a guy that had really done nothing to divert his career from becoming a Supreme Court justice, and he was very polished and calculating. And now that he is in a position to pass his, ideological preferences, he seems to be doing that wildly, and I think it's a big mistake for the court. I think there will be political retribution, and hopefully, unless the process is so corrupted that a few oligarchs get to pick our representatives, we will end up with a swing the other way and replace him at some point.
Well, I don't know. Now the McCutcheon decision, let's clarify here, the McCutcheon decision has allowed rich people or poor people with tons of money to spread their donations all over the map. And the new is there actually a limit now on how much money you can spend on political campaigns?
You can spend an unlimited amount of money in the aggregate on political campaigns. That was the McCutcheon decision, but it left in place these fig leaf barriers on individual donations. So I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but you can only give only in air quotes a few thousand dollars to every member of Congress. So in that sense, it is limited. You can give an unlimited amount of money to, advocacy groups and super PACs, which you could do before. And what McCutcheon does is it eliminates the total aggregate amount limit, which you could give to candidates and to parties. So now you could, in theory, give to every member of Congress and both political parties, and there's no limit on that total amount. But there is on an individual basis. It's really a fig leaf, though, because you could give to these other third-party groups that basically act in concert with the campaigns, although they're not supposed to.
Right, and in keeping with the infamous Citizens United decision, it's not just people now, it's corporations can give these donations. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think the Citizens United decision, I think McCutcheon it's been called Citizens United 2.0 or things like that, and I really don't think it is. I think Citizens United is really, really heinous and awful and scary in a way that this isn't. I know a lot of people are really concerned and justifiably upset about McCutcheon, but I think it does an injustice to the injustice of Citizens United to lump them together casually. I think they are related, and they are certainly showing a trend of where the court wants to go, which is unlimited money in campaigns and in politics. But I think Citizens United really in recognizing the personhood of corporations, which is such a specious and ridiculous idea, is much more dangerous.
Yeah, and this idea of corporate personhood, as a history professor, you run the risk of hearing this from me. But it originates with the 14th Amendment, which was designed to protect the rights of freed Black people, ex-slaves, in the South, and it basically guaranteed the right of persons to due process, and then some corporate whatever in the 1870s or 80s came up with the idea that corporations were persons under the law. They never really got an explicit confirmation of that from the courts, but there was a sort of a trend of de facto decisions that gave the corporations human rights, but no human responsibilities. And it was never really explicit into law until the Citizen Action decision, which basically said that corporations are people. So the question that I have then is, if corporations are people, are they subject to the death penalty? And why not?
Yeah. Yeah, well, they don't seem to be punished the same way that people are punished, right? That's actually a great point, Harvey. I mean, these corporations, when they go ahead and contribute to the deaths of countless people, they're then, if they, to the extent that they're punished at all, they get punished with fines, right? No one comes around and says, you have to dissolve this company, it's beyond repair. I mean, that's a good point, and no one throws them in jail. And there is really no corporate accountability in America. My dad makes the point often, and it's worth repeating, and I'll steal his point, that, you know, a lot of these corporations are multinational corporations, and they have a lot of their employees and a lot of their revenue comes from overseas. You know, they basically treat America as a market. They don't really pay taxes, and they have crazy protections here. And to the extent that it's in the national interest, they're not really honoring that commitment to put jobs here, to pay taxes, to put money back into the society. So they take a lot and they don't give a lot back.
And there's no account. You mentioned the key word, which is accountability. I mean, corporations in this country are above the law. They're above the civil law. They're above the criminal law, and they appear to believe that they're above the laws of nature, because you know, obviously they destroy our ecosystems at every opportunity without any kind of retribution at all from the species that they destroy, be they fish or algae or human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should talk about your piece. You know, we are going to post it today, just pretty much around the time I get off the air. So. If you want to talk about it.
Well, what title are we working with? What's the working title of my piece? I'm always excited to see what title comes down on my piece of Truth Dig.
You know, I don't know yet, but let's go with what your title. Let's use that for now.
Okay, Fighting the Fossil Nuke Extinction, and this is pretty much what it's about. So the last piece I had with you, which went all over the place, was called The Nuclear Omnicide. And I teach at a campus here right around the corner, and I was riding my bike across campus the day that piece came out. And one of my colleagues was walking in the opposite direction, and she looked at me, and she said, "Omnicide." I was really impressed, you know. So the point of that piece was essentially that nuclear power. We've been involved in this huge debate, and it's a very corporate debate. It really cuts to the core of corporate unaccountability. We've had this huge debate about how the nuclear power industry, whether or not it kills people. And we've had this faction within the global anti-global warming movement, but also, of course, as part of the core of the corporate assault of the nuclear industry on our ecosystem, our ecosphere, that the assertion is that the amounts of radiation that escape from places like Fukushima, Chernobyl, and Three Mile Island, but also the so-called normal activity of nuclear plants, is not enough to kill human beings. And the point of my piece is to argue, of course, it is, but nonetheless, it is killing smaller species, more vulnerable species all over the planet. And if we have ascertained, which we did in 1956, the work of Alice Stewart, Dr. Alice Stewart, a British doctor, undertook a study of what was causing childhood leukemia in England, and she was completely... had no sense whatsoever of an agenda about nuclear radiation, but she did include on the questionnaire a survey of whether women who were whose children had had childhood leukemia had been X-rayed, and she found of all the things that were tested for or surveyed, the most reliable way to cause childhood leukemia was to for the mother to undergo X-ray. And when she published this finding, they damn near crucified this woman. And, you know, they fought her for 30 years on it. So the upshot is that if a single radiation dose of the level of a medical X-ray to a pregnant woman, to a human embryo, can cause a doubled leukemia rate, what does a small dose of X-ray do to the embryos of fish and of starfish and to the phytoplankton and the algae and the amoeba and all the other creatures in the sea? And okay, the answer, of course, is it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you point out in your latest article this false choice between nuclear power and carbon power, and that both are really bad, and it is a false choice. There is a third way, not to go off that term, but let's go ahead.
Right, and, right, right. Please.
And I think this relates to our earlier discussion, actually, because, you know, you have a lot of people saying, well, you know, you'll have the corporations giving to Republicans and unions giving to the Democrats. And what we actually see is they give to both. Corporations give to Democrats and Republicans. And we've seen a real narrowing of their worldview to the point where we can't get, you know, we can't get anything done on climate change because the big money in politics has made sure that both parties are in their pocket. And so, you know, to the extent that we have a debate about energy, it's do we go nuclear or do we go with coal or clean coal or whatever, you know. And, you know, we have a situation now where we have this pipeline. They're trying to build the Keystone Pipeline across the country. And you see in the local level, the politics gets really interesting because you've got places like Pennsylvania where it is a job creator, and at the same time, the people it's creating jobs for have to deal with earthquakes, they have to deal with poison water, and they're finding that they maybe regret the build-out of the fracking industry.
Yeah,
sorry,
it's a nightmare.
I went all over the place there.
And so much of the state of West Virginia has lost its drinking water. And, you know, this is a big deal. Now, you're in California, and there's a major fight going on over fracking. Have you followed that at all?
Not closely, but I did notice that it was, you know, for as much as we hear about California being a blue state and dominated by the Democrats, we've been had cause to be disappointed in the Democrats and their resistance to these fracking. I suspect for the same reasons that it's gone down in Pennsylvania, which is that, you know, we're in a tough economy and people want jobs and there is popular support. And it's very sad and short-sighted, but it is a quick fix to a problem that creates ultimately much more devastating and scary problems. California has such a strange history when it comes to the environment. You know, people have taken the long view, but it often requires some form of disaster. You know, here in Los Angeles, we still have terrible smog and pollution, but it's the reason that we have, you know, such an interest in clean air. We have the terrible oil spill in Santa Barbara, but it's part of the reason that people are so concerned about preserving our coastline here. So we often, it takes a disaster to do the right thing, sadly.
Well, I will say, you know, I am not a big fan of that. I am almost as old as your dad. Peter Shear, our guest is Peter Shear. He's the managing editor of the TruthDig.com website, a wonderful, very powerful site. And, of course, your dad, Bob, is a very well-known journalist, columnist, activist over the decades, from parts and on up, but the fact is that what's happening in California does happen everywhere else, and you being in California, there we see the impact of the Democrats and their inability to, as they say in professional basketball, get spacing, or as a pro football receiver would say, separation from the Republicans. And now we've got Jerry Brown in the White House. I mean, I knew Jerry Brown way back when. I want to walk up to him one of these days and say, Jerry, I haven't seen you since you were governor of California. What have you been doing lately? He was with us against nuclear power when the Diablo Canyon plants were coming online in the 80s. He was responsible as governor for the tax breaks that allowed the construction of 17,000 windmills. I mean, there was a time in this world before Reagan and Reagan came along where 95%. 95% of the wind-driven electricity was in the world was produced in California, and you know that's long gone now. Brown has been, well, correct me if I'm wrong, Peter Shear, but Brown has been less than pure. Let's put it that way about fracking. I mean, we don't seem to be getting a whole lot of support from Sacramento in fighting fracking. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't, as I said, I haven't followed it too closely, unfortunately. I do think Brown has become, to use the kind word, more pragmatic in his politics as he is looking to retain his office. And, you know, he's been beat pretty bad in the past, and I think he wants to walk a middle road if he can. This has come up with other issues recently. It's not just on the environment. I mean, I personally think he's basically a good guy and wants to do right by California, but I do think he is, the governor of a complex state who's looking to get reelected. So I don't mean to apologize for him at all. It's as you say, you know, he's been on different sides of it. He's been with you and now he's in charge, and it's,
well, gosh, let me ask you a question.
I don't know what to make of this situation.
I've been told the
water issue, which is, you know, very interesting and complicated. And historically, going back to the movie Chinatown, you know, it's sort of the origin of California's crazy politics is the water politics.
Well, tell us a little about that, because, you know, water in California, I mean, I go to L.A. a lot because I have a daughter and a grandson there, as well as a son-in-law and his parents. And I walk over what is laughingly called the Los Angeles River, and it's a concrete gully or something.
You know,
I
mean,
I never see any water in there. To call it a river is like, you know, a joke.
L.A. is a big basin. I'm going to defend the L.A. River. L.A. is a big basin, and what happened was the river, you know, historically before people lived here, would change its course wildly from the mountains to the ocean. And so what the sort of the city planners back in the day did is they made a concrete, they sort of forced it to be, you know, one place all the time. And it's not really a river. It's something that expands and contracts. But there are parts of it that are actually being restored by activists in the community and with help from the city that are quite beautiful. And they have, like, little canoe trips. You can take down stretches of it where they're restoring plant life and bird life. So it is actually an activist success story, the LA River. But, yeah, water politics in California is so messed up. And it really goes to this issue of global warming. You know, California produces, I think, 80% of the world, of all the almonds grown in the whole world. And it's like that with a lot of crops. California is one of America's breadbaskets. And a lot of that comes from stealing water from the Colorado River, from the Sierra Nevada mountains, and channeling it into this big open space, this arid scrubland we have across the state, and irrigating these huge stretches of farms that grow all sorts of crazy crops. And, you know, it's 88 degrees here in LA today, which wouldn't be so remarkable if it wasn't like this also in December and January. It was hitting the 80s. So, you know, I question, as much as I love California and as huge and important as the economy of California is to the United States of America, and including the agricultural sector, and perhaps especially the agricultural sector, I question the degree to which we can continue to have these artificial farms and these artificial cities like Los Angeles that keep growing when there's less and less water and drier and drier land.
It is a real question. We're talking with Peter Scheer, the editor, a managing editor of truthdig.com. It's hard not to talk about California. It's such a fascinating entity. But let's jump back and finish what we started with, which is the money and politics situation, and mm-hmm. and then let's segue back into these interesting issues. The question of money and politics just has become a dominant question in our country. And you cover a lot of this at Truth Day. You got very political writers, Chris Hedges and your dad and some other really good ones. And we really have to wonder, Peter Scheer, can we really legitimately say that the United States is a democracy at this point in time, given the power of money in politics?
You know, it's funny. I keep having these fights with my dad about Russia. He takes a much more complicated view of Russia than some people. And we go back and forth on it, and we talk about things like the corruption, oligarchy, free press, And on all these things, I end up feeling really hypocritical. In the United States of America, we have these treasured ideals, and they really are under full assault on every level of government, the local, the state, the national. And as much attention as we pay to the Supreme Court, we should also pay attention to our own backyards. I think David Sirota has a story on Pando Daily today about how Rahm Emanuel, a mayor of Chicago, channeled money away from schools and into the pockets of his donors, allegedly. I don't know enough about it to say definitively, but allegedly. It happens on all levels of politics. People can, what do they say, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But also little bits of power can be corrosive to a person's conscience. And, even before Citizens United, corporations had plenty of leverage over American politics. How often do you see ads on CNN for petroleum companies and you wonder, what are they selling? They're selling the influence they have over CNN to pull that advertising. They have an economic lever over the media. And the same is true of, political campaigns. Corporations were already free to spend money in advertising their causes and in influencing candidates. Now they can just do it more directly. And what's scary is if they don't have to report it. So I was speaking with someone at the Sunlight Foundation, which is a great organization that tries to resist this. And they said their first priority in the wake of these Supreme Court decisions is disclosure. And right now, campaigns and candidates have to disclose, I think, in cycles, and it's like a 3-month waiting period to find out who gave what to whom. And that's for the, not super secret super PACs or channeling it through third party nonprofits. That's if you give directly to a candidate, your own money. And what they want to do is speed that up to a 3-day period or even less, so that the campaigns have to disclose almost immediately when they get money and from whom. And I think that's a good first step. And there's a bill working its way through Congress, hopefully, that they're supporting.
Well, I can't imagine this Congress passing such a bill. And of course, Clarence Thomas spoke to the point that Clarence Thomas ever speaks, wrote something, I think he actually wrote an opinion on this against disclosure, worrying that people who give money and were disclosed to have been given money would then be subject to some kind of retribution. I am concerned. I mean, as an American historian, my initial specialization was in the period after the Civil War, when the corporations really did take over the Gilded Age and the age of Thomas Nast, and the corporations completely owned the Congress and the presidency, and it was an ugly time. It was a really ugly time. And now these guys, the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, they're on a whole other level. At least Morgan and Rockefeller Carnegie in particular had some kind of social conscience. The Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and all these other guys, man, they seem completely sociopathic and completely cut off from both the rest of the society and the planet. Or am
but
I being too harsh?
Win. I think they are to the left what some people on the left are to the right, in that they're sort of boogeymen, and it's they help us rally our focus and our energy and our donations. But they are oligarchs. They are definitely individuals with tremendous power over the politics of our country, and they often get what they want. Not just our country, by the way, other countries. You saw Sheldon Adelson used his money. He uses it like a hammer in places like Israel and in China. So he gets what he wants wherever he goes. He increased his net worth dramatically by turning around the Chinese government on a development in Macau that has netted him a huge amount of money. So, yes, these people are very effective in how they use their money, but I'm much more concerned about how the Monsantos and the GEs use their money and the Chase Manhattan banks, right? JP Morgan Chase, excuse me.
Well, listen, let's come back to that, Peter. We've got to take a break. We're talking with Peter Scheer, the managing editor of TruthDig.com, poised to post another one of my pieces on the environment and the false choice between fossil fuels and nuclear power. We're going to take a break for 3 minutes. We'll listen to my good buddy Dana Lyons singing the Rocky Top version of Solartopia, and we'll be right back with you.
New plan. Freeze pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solar Tokyo is home sweet home to me.
All right, that's my buddy Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top song. I love Dana Lyons. I love his Cows with Guns, the anthem of the vegetarian movement. We're talking with Peter Scheer from Los Angeles. Peter is the managing editor of TruthDig.com. Let's go through. I'm on your front page here, Peter. You've got sections here. What is the ear to the ground? You've got you just ran a piece here about the power of glucosamine to make life go longer, and you've got some other ear to the ground. You have Edward Snowden saying the NSA spied on Amnesty International. There's a big surprise. what defines your ear to the ground section?
Our ear to the ground section is our blog section, and we try to highlight stories that maybe people have missed or didn't get the attention they deserve, or on the other hand, are so important in the news that we just can't ignore them, like what's going on in Ukraine, for instance.
All right, so you've got an East Ukraine city face separatist split here, and is that written by someone in over there?
Yes.
Okay, and then you've got Larry's List about
Larry's
greed.
List. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. The Ukraine story is a reposted story from Agence France-Presse. The Larry's List is a great feature we run on a regular basis. Larry Gross is, well, he's taking a sabbatical, but he was the director of the Communication and Journalism School at USC, and he's one of the founders of Queer Studies, which is, gender studies, gay issues.
Uh-huh.
And he's a brilliant guy and has an incredible network of people funneling links to him to really interesting and wild stories, and Larry's List is sort of the best of his pick. And it's a great place to, it's sort of a microcosm of the ear to the ground section. It's a great feature because so many of those stories are just fascinating little news items that don't really make it out of into the mainstream discussion.
Okay, and then in the lead slot, the featured report, which I assume that's where my next piece will go, in the featured report. Is that where
you
put my stuff?
Absolutely.
You've got a piece by Bill Boyarsky about how the Republicans make Obama look good. You've got a picture of a couple of Saudi sheiks in the background. Are you implying that the Saudi sheiks are Republicans? What's the deal here?
You know, no, I actually chose that photo, and I was looking for a photo of the president smiling, and I like this one a lot, and it spoke to me, so I went with it. But yeah, you can read into it whatever you want. Bill's point, which is really interesting because Bill Boyarsky is the former city editor of the LA Times. He's covered politics on a national and local level for decades, and he has taken a lot of heat on TruthDig as the guy who, I'm going to use his words here, he says, we Obama apologists had grown desperate. And he has been the guy who's sort of making the argument to our more progressive and our libertarian and our more anti-Obama, our green, you know, just all the people who've sort of been frustrated with the president. Bill's been the guy who's been out there saying, look, you know, overall, Obamacare will be good. It's a step in the right direction. And he just said, we apologists had grown desperate. And he goes into a lot of the problems, you know, the NSA spying, the drone kill list, all these horrible things. And he makes the point that, you know, yet again, out of the woodwork, when at the point of our desperation, with all these angry comments on TruthDig on his article, here comes Paul Ryan to show how mean the Republicans can be and that their alternative, again, makes Obama look good. just when, you know, we're heading into the midterm elections and after that another presidential election that is wide open and gives both parties a chance to reinvent themselves, we have a situation where, you know, this budget plan of Paul Ryan's, which is really quite cruel and doesn't do anything to fix the budget crisis to the extent that there is one, or the deficit, it's just mean-spirited and it really bails out Obama.
Yeah, well, we hope, we see, because, you know, one thing, and I don't want to go off into a whole other tangent here, but we have been unable to get, and I live in Columbus, Ohio, and my buddy Bob Fetrakis and I broke most of the major stories about the theft of the 2004 election, which was done primarily by electronic voting machines. And we still can't get many of the websites and of the sort of Democrat-leaning, party-leaning, community to acknowledge that to the extent, and you'll love this, Peter. I one of the places I have posted my articles in recent times is the Daily Kos, KOS. And, you know, they're the snarkiest of the, commentators at Daily Kos. You put a piece up, boy, you're going to get, it's like, you know, putting yourself on one of those things where people throw stuff at the target and they dunk you in the pool. I posted, one of our pieces about, I said that if Mitt Romney, if the election had come down to Ohio, and that if Mitt Romney was in 5 points, within 5 points, they would have stolen it. And, you know, I grew up in this town, and Bob is a professor of political science. He's been here 25 years, and we know Ohio politics pretty well. And I will guarantee you that the 2004 election was stolen, and they could have done it in 2012 if it had been closer. And I was personally escorted off the Daily Kos website by Marcos, however you pronounce his last
Malesis,
name.
Yeah.
I was kind of honored, actually. I think this is a reality people are going to have to face. You know, my fear is that no matter how bad the Republicans get, no matter how bad they look in the eyes of the human race, that they are really working hard to disenfranchise the public, and they're doing a pretty good job as far as I can tell. And of course, these Supreme Court decisions aren't going to help.
Well, Ohio is a great state to live to the extent that you want to disproportionately influence American politics, because it has become the most important swing state. It has become the bellwether state in these elections, and whoever takes Ohio tends to take the election. And we've seen that, you know, when Bush won in 2000 and 2004, and Obama won in 2008 and 2012. And, you know, all this attention was focused in 2000 on Florida, and Ohio, Gore lost by, I think, 160,000 votes.
He didn't really. I mean, you know, we know what they do here. We're right in the belly of the beast here, and it's very disconcerting. And we have a governor now. We'll give you one idea. You know, Ohio voted for solid majorities for Obama and Sherrod Brown, the liberal U.S. senator, in the last election. But the gerrymandering is so bad in Ohio that with a majority of Democratic voters, the congressional delegation, I think, it's 12-6. I mean, it's almost 2-1 Republican. And both houses of the state house here are overwhelmingly Republican, 2/3 and 3/4, even though the state itself is a majority Democrat. I mean, it is really, really like living in occupied territory here.
Well,
so,
that's, you know, a point that Bill Boyarsky has been making on our site. We were talking about him a minute ago. He's currently in the big box on truthdig.com. And the point he's been making over and over again is that these battles are being fought and lost in the state houses, where Republicans have really succeeded in targeting and gerrymandering and taking these state houses, where they're able to influence federal politics on a crazy scale. You know, in Ohio, the district I'm most familiar with belonged to Dennis Kucinich, and he was merged with, I think, Marcy Kaptur, is that her name?
That's correct. But, and you know, the Democrats did that. They made a deal. The Republicans made a deal with them in the gerrymandering that if they would sacrifice Dennis, they would get, you know, X, Y, and Z. And my buddy Bob Fetrakis, who's a political scientist, knows the details. I can't stomach it anymore. I get physically ill when I go into the state house here. It's just horrifying. And I actually know the governor, John Kasich. I was on his show at Fox News. And, you got to take Prozac or something to deal with this. It's very, very difficult. Although I will say one thing, John Kasich and myself and Roger Federer and George W. Bush have one truly great thing in common, which is that we are all the fathers of twin daughters. So that we do, we do reserve that. But, it's very, very depressing.
It's come as a shock to me.
What's that?
I said I thought you were going to say you were all Swiss, which would come as a shock to me.
Well, there are rumors. I have five daughters. I'd be hard to sell to the gay community, but there have been persistent rumors about the governor, John Kasich. There's no doubt he's a pothead. I have talked to many, many people who knew him in college, the governor here, and that he did smoke pot. And, even obviously Barack Obama smoked pot, and he's still busting people all over the country. And Jerry Brown's attitudes toward marijuana have been astonishing to me. We're going to get off on a deep tangent here. I want to go back to your Truth Dig site for a minute. I love the fact that on the top right corner you have a petition, We Want Medicare for All. And as someone who is now on Medicare, I heartily back that. That's one of the disappointments with Obama, is that, you know, we've got Obamacare, and okay, it's an improvement and all that, but he missed a golden opportunity for a national dialogue on single payer. And I can tell you right offhand, right off the bat, I'm 68, and Medicare is a fantastic program. And it would have been so wonderful if we could have just segued right into a program that's been proven and that works, and just give it to everybody. And that's a disappointment with Obama, there's no doubt.
Yeah, I have very complicated feelings about Obamacare. I am on Obamacare. I have an ACA plan through Covered California, and I have a pre-existing condition. So I am one of those people that, you know, the big selling point of the plan appeals to me. At the same time, I remember covering the whole healthcare bill as it was being passed. He had tremendous political capital. He had huge majorities in the House and Senate. He had a lot of trouble passing something because he had a lot of bought-off Democrats, a lot of blue dog Democrats, particularly in the Senate, who had taken a lot of money from the healthcare industry. Actually, no one took more money than Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton from the healthcare industry. And you notice there are certain things like prescriptions that just, you know, the pharmaceutical industry managed to avoid the whole debate, which is kind of shocking.
Right.
But, the thing that's really upsetting to me is the whole farce over the public option, because Obama really let the Tea Party Republicans and the insurance industry kill the public option without mounting anything of a fight. And at its absolute lowest popularity, the public option still pulled with a majority supporting it. Even in the height of these town hall meetings where people were supposedly screaming about it, and the media gave that wild play. I mean, that was all over cable news for weeks on end. And even at that point, a majority of Americans wanted a public health care option to be included in these exchanges. And that at least would have done something to compete with these. You know, my insurer is a nonprofit insurer, yet they manage to make millions in profits every year. CEO is paying
lavishly.
I love
that, yeah.
So, there's no honesty in the healthcare industry, even when you have nonprofit providers. And we really do need a government option. If it's not Medicare, then it ought to be something else. The simplest thing, though, would have been Medicare, because it's constitutionally unassailable. Everyone who has it likes that they have it. Even the Republicans can't argue against it. If they dare come out against Medicare, they're guaranteed to lose that election, whoever the candidate is. So, that would have been the way to go. But
yeah, and, the faulting of Obama on this, and I'm going to talk about Obama one more minute after this, but the faulting of Obama on this is not that he didn't deliver Medicare for everybody, that he would not allow the dialogue. You know, when it came to really debating health care, he cut off the public option people. And that was just completely wrong. And, you know, I'm going to give you a quick example. I had a minor heart procedure. It wasn't even they didn't open me up. They went up through my veins and did a something on my some nerve in my heart for tachycardia, which is well known. And I did it at the Cleveland Clinic. And I was on the table maybe 2 hours. Of course, I don't remember. I did ask them to play Bonnie Raitt's music while I was on the table. I do remember that. And I came out and everything was successful. And they put me in a room in the Cleveland Clinic, which was freezing, and I caught a cold. And I went home and didn't exercise for a week, and everything was fine. And I have Medicare and I have a backup. And the bill, the bill for one night in that, in the Cleveland Clinic and a relatively minor procedure was, $60,000. You know, and God forbid if I didn't have Medicare, that would be the end of my kids' college education. You know, we'd have to move into an apartment. My parents lived in to be 74, 75, 76. And in the last years of their life, you know, if we had had to pay, my mother's every day got up and said, thank God for Medicare. If we had had to pay their bills, you know, none of my kids would have gone to college. I couldn't be a teacher. It's devastating. And so I will say this, that I hope to God at some point we can get Medicare for everybody. It would be, and of course that's what they have in Europe essentially, and in Canada. And there's no reason except that the power of our medical industry, as you pointed out, is too great here. I want to say one thing about Obama real quick. You know, I have not been disappointed because I had no expectations. But he did do the one thing that, and the most important thing that Barack Obama has successfully done, is that when he ran for president, he promised he would put an African American in the White House. And he's put five, himself, his wife, his two kids, and his mother-in-law. And so whatever else happens with him, and, you know, he's been just another mediocre president as far as I'm concerned. You know, I've studied the presidents. We've had some great ones. We have some horrible ones. He proved he has been competent, which you could not say about George W. Bush. He has handled the job. And he can speak in complete sentences. He still can, as a matter of fact. That much has been good. So of the 46 presidents we've had, I'd put him in, roughly in the middle, same as Clinton. And that's it. So, but, you know, and that's why I actually, well, I'm going to support Jill Stein if she runs again in 2016. But, you know, I'll be hoping that Hillary wins, not for any political expectation, but I think we should have a woman. I think it's been very, very important. People take it for granted now. I think it's very important in the scope of history that we have had an African American president and that he's been reelected. And just on the face of it, literally and figuratively, I think that's very important. And the rest of it, you know, we get what we get.
People underestimate the difficulty of that posed to his campaign, how just incredibly racist this country is. I have a friend who worked in the Obama, in both Obama campaigns, and in places like Indiana where he worked, people would every night steal all the Obama yard signs and then return them with racial epithets written over them. I mean, he just saw incredible racism on the ground, just, you know, overt racism, not even subtle institutional racism. And I do think it's an incredible, it is an achievement for this country. It is a shame, though, when we talk about it as if it's in the past tense, because of his achievement and because of our cultural achievement, finally electing a black president.
And I have to say, as a person, he's handled it very well. You know, aside from the politics, you know, which are what they are, I think on a personal level, he's handled the presence of an African American president, I think, you know, with great grace, actually.
Well, it's interesting that we often, the things that we complain and argue about, I mean, it never comes up. And what we talk about with Obama are, you know, the degree to which we're pleased or dissatisfied with him. And I do think that is a cultural achievement for this country, that the man is being judged on his work and not his skin.
Yes, and even with the name, I mean, who would have ever thought, as a historian, you look back at the names of the presidents, and this guy's name is Barack Obama? I mean, really?
It's a Muslim name. Barack Hussein Obama.
I know, it's mind-boggling. Well, it's also a tribute, I think, to how horrible George W. Bush was. And that's why it's so terrifying to see in the last couple of weeks Jeb Bush coming along. I mean, Jeb Bush is way, way smarter than his brother. And he actually does speak Spanish, and he's a meaner guy. He's a much meaner guy than George W. was.
Yeah, I'm sure he was very unhappy when George W. won. Because I just can't. I mean, as wide as our reach is on Truthdig, we have a great Facebook following. And I was looking at some of the comments yesterday when we posted about Jeb Bush, officially considering a run. And the reaction from people of just all political stripes is just to be so sick of these political dynasties. Even with Hillary Clinton, where, you know, she has been just a figure that has constantly been in and around the White House and is part of a political dynasty. And with the Bushes, oh, my God, it goes back to Prescott. You know, I mean, it's just insane. This sort of American royalty that goes against everything that the founders fought for. And people really pick up on that. And I don't think Jeb Bush, I think if he manages to get elected, it is overcoming really a public disdain for that idea of one family getting, you know, born into access. And I say this as someone who works for his father, but born into, you know, getting to be president because his dad and his brother were, and it's just insane.
It's terrifying. I mean, I've followed him pretty. I've been involved in some Florida issues. I was on a board about the Florida Everglades, and he is a horrible guy. He's just really nasty, mean, uncaring. I mean, he's almost, you would almost say he's pathologically incapable of empathy, which is a known psychological quality. I think George W. Bush had that too. And certainly H.W., the father, he's a, all right, we don't need to go into it. Listen, it's been very pleasurable talking politics with you, Peter. We just have 4 or 5 minutes left. Tell us what you'd like your readership to know about Truthdig. And, I'm always honored to be published there. I have a piece that's going to be on there momentarily about nuclear power and fossil fuels. But tell us what you'd like people to know about Truthdig.com.
Oh, I don't know. We are an independent news outlet. Those are becoming increasingly rare and special things in this country. And, you know, we always appreciate new visitors. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that we try to present a diversity of opinion. We don't like to be pigeonholed. And it's funny to me as an editor of the site, how often people attribute what our columnists are saying to the site as a whole, as if we're writing with one voice. We really try to get some debate going on the page. So if people would visit us, read the articles, weigh in with their own comments, we appreciate it.
And I will say, in the defense of your diversity, I'm looking at the page here. Beneath the petition for the ad for the Medicare for All, you have an ad for the Atlantis resort in the Bahamas. And then my favorite, you have an attractive, well-tanned young woman with the question, single and Christian. So yeah. Somebody must think you have a pretty diverse, leadership there at Truthdig.
We are actually we have a new ad person coming on, and they haven't yet had a chance to do their thing, but we belong to a lot of these ad networks, which is how a lot of sites get revenue, and they're all automated, and you don't really have very much control over what's put on your page, and it's all tied, as Google has pioneered, to certain keywords. And we ran an article that became wildly popular about the proprietor of Girls Gone Wild, and it was sort of just like a news brief on something that went down with him. And we started getting all of these horrible ads for, like, mail-order brides. And
you know, all right. Listen, I'm going to have you back, Peter. We're out of time. I will answer that question, single and Christian, and say no and no to both of them. I look forward to the piece popping up at some point on nuclear power and
today,
fossil fuels, the false choice. Peter, you have a great radio voice and a great radio presence. It's great to have you on. We'll have you back, maybe with your dad. I hope he's feeling better.
Yeah,
This has been Peter Scheer, the editor, managing editor of TruthDig.com on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Another hour that has flown by. See us again at PRN. We're moving forward. And we are so happy to have you with us. Take it away, Pete, and take us back to Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
We bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn metal.